Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Karen Perry Stillerman of the Union of Concerned Scientists Food and Environment Program, who challenges the Monsanto Corporation's claim on the benefits of genetically engineered food crops. Paul Anastas, former science advisor to the Environmental Protection Agency, who provides an insider's view on how scientific data is used to formulate government policy. And Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein, who talks about her Green New Deal platform and why she's urging progressive voters to consider supporting her candidacy this November. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Before the debt crisis swallowed up the Eurozone, Madrid College graduate Nuria Lafuente founded a new online business, Yo Voy, Spanish for I Go. The online enterprise acted as an exchange, linking people looking for services with those offering services through bartering. Lafuente charges a fee for her time to make a connection, like filing an immigration application or organizing a party. According to the Christian Science Monitor, Yo Voy is at the center of a resurgent cooperative sector in hard-hit Spain that has been plagued by a banking crisis and 20% unemployment. Spaniards are looking to cooperatives for services the government and banks no longer provide. They are also moving their money out of national banks and into locally focused ethical banks that refuse to engage in speculative investments. The growing popularity of bartering and exchanges in Spain, although operating on a small scale, has opened up space for alternatives to big banks and multinational corporations. Ansel Cambra, who started the popular bartering website Acaba con la Crisis, or End the Crisis, declared, "We are turning things around, returning to an economy from years ago. This way we can learn to value what we have and what we don't." Former machinist Bruce Rivers now lives on an oxygen respirator at the age of 58. For 12 years, he worked with beryllium, a versatile light metal, at various factories in Southern California that manufacture high-tech ceramics for the aerospace industry, the military, and auto companies. At the time, he used a respirator to protect himself from fine metallic dust. Despite his precautions, he was diagnosed with chronic beryllium disease in 2009. According to the Center for Public Integrity, the safety standard for beryllium dates back to research by the Atomic Energy Commission in 1949. For the last dozen years, health and labor advocates have pushed for a new health standard, but were blocked by opponents in the industry as well as government red tape. Another new health rule affecting 2 million workers has been stalled for the mineral silica, which is used widely in construction and foundries. University of Maryland law professor Rena Steinzer noted the backlash against even the simplest efforts to protect workers is withering. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, hasn't made a serious run at regulating chemicals in the workplace in a couple of decades. In April, the Government Accountability Office announced that it takes OSHA 8 years on average to issue a new health standard. OSHA has only issued 11 new health regulations since 2000. Tougher standards on beryllium and silica would cost businesses hundreds of millions of dollars by requiring companies to pay for respirators, health screenings, and dust control equipment. Yet it would save workers' lives. Currently, over 50,000 U.S. workers die each year from occupational diseases, 10 times the rate of traumatic injuries. This summer, it's getting tougher to beat the heat. The Natural Resources Defense Council reports that nearly 25,000 beaches were closed due to health precautions in 2010, the second highest number of closings since the Green Group started keeping count. The surge in beach closings is caused by high bacteria levels in water that can cause a number of illnesses, including rashes, pink eye, hepatitis, and stomach flu. Bacteria enter the waters through untreated runoff from roads, parking lots, and roofs. In the mid-1980s, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency established new health standards for beach waters, setting a limit on bacteria levels. But in the current budget crunch, the Obama administration is threatening to cut off state education grants to alert the public about health hazards in swimming areas. According to E! The Environmental magazine, the Surfrider Foundation has launched a campaign to save the EPA grants, arguing without federal funding, many states will seriously cut back or even entirely curtail their beach monitoring programs. No more water testing means no more health warnings. Environmental groups, including the NRDC, are looking for ways to stop polluted stormwater from reaching waterways, Activists are now trying to enlist municipal governments to invest in green infrastructure such as green rooftops, ocean-friendly gardens, curbside vegetation, and rainwater collection barrels that can help eliminate the source of high bacteria counts at public beaches. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
The Monsanto Corporation, an international leader in biotechnology, is currently spending millions of dollars on an advertising campaign to convince the public and politicians that the genetically engineered food crops that they've developed and are marketing is helping to feed more people, protecting natural resources, and promoting biodiversity. Monsanto's slogan is, "We're all in this together, producing more, conserving more, improving lives." But the Union of Concerned Scientists, which has studied Monsanto's claims, challenges many of the company's assertions of benefits for agriculture and society. To that end, the union has produced their own series of advertisements placed on Washington, D.C. buses and transit stations near the U.S. Department of Agriculture, with the goal of setting the record straight on genetically modified crops. In one ad, the union declares that Monsanto's Roundup Ready crops, genetically engineered to tolerate the company's Roundup herbicide, increased herbicide use by an estimated 383 million pounds between 1996 and 2008, and monarch butterflies have laid 81% fewer eggs thanks to habitat loss since Roundup Ready was introduced. Another ad asserts that Monsanto's products aren't the answer to meeting the needs of a hungry planet. The union says that genetically engineered crops have so far done little to improve yields in the U.S. Your reporter spoke with Karen Perry Stillerman, senior analyst with the Union of Concerned Scientists Food and Environment Program, who challenges the Monsanto Corporation's claims on the benefits of genetically engineered food crops.
Well, and I should say that Monsanto is not the only company that's doing this, but they are the industry leader. And so we've looked at the industry, but we've also looked some at Monsanto's specific products. And so a couple of years ago, in 2009, actually, we produced a report called Failure to Yield. And we decided to look at these problems one by one and the claims one by one. So we wanted to look. They were saying at the time, Monsanto was running a big ad campaign on public radio, in fact, and places like New Yorker Magazine and other places, and they were specifically saying that their seeds were increasing yields. So we looked at that, and my colleague Doug Gray and Sherman looked at the data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the scientific literature to really kind of tease out, well, what is the situation with the crops that Monsanto is and other companies are genetically engineering? Are they really increasing in yields, and is the genetic splicing that they're doing, is that what's responsible? And what we found is, you know, of course, over the past decade or more, yields of crops like corn and soybeans have gone up dramatically. Farmers are producing more. But when we really teased out what was responsible, we found out that it was mostly attributable to just common plant breeding and improved farming techniques, and that in fact the genes that the companies were putting in there, you know, one of which Monsanto uses to make the crops tolerate herbicides, weed killers, and so you can plant the crop and then spray herbicides over it once it's growing, and the crop itself doesn't die, but the weeds do, and that's a really great thing for farmers. But what it doesn't do is help increase yields, and so if we're interested in increasing food production, that doesn't do it.
Karen, in your research looking at some of the problems associated with genetically modified crop seeds, I read a report that said that Roundup Ready crops, which are resistant to that particular Roundup pesticide, may be associated with a reduction in the population of monarch butterflies in the Midwest. Do you want to tell our listeners a bit about that?
Well, it's part of the problem with agriculture on an industrial scale as we're practicing it today. You know, the Roundup and other herbicides are used to keep fields weed-free. And as the price of things like corn has gone up in recent years, farmers have planted more and more of it, so they're leaving less and less land in sort of a more natural, weedy state. And monarch butterflies just happen to be a species that rely on certain kinds of weeds to lay their eggs in and to eat. So it is a problem that the more herbicides that are used and the, you know, more land area that is kept free of weeds of all kinds, the less kind of diversity that you're going to see. And it's not necessarily something that Monsanto set out to do, but it is an impact of the industrial kind of agriculture that their products really perpetuate and exacerbate.
So, Karen, what's the objective of the Union of Concerned Scientists campaign here? What would you like to see in terms of new regulations on companies like Monsanto that produce genetically modified crop seeds? Is that where you want to go with this in terms of having more stringent regulation here? Or is it just to give the public and farmers more awareness of these claims, which you believe are false?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, we do want to see these kinds of experimental crops or genetically engineered crops regulated more tightly for lots of reasons, because the regulation is pretty lax and, you know, in terms of really being able to sort out things like health impacts and environmental impacts, we'd like to see more study done, and the regulations don't require that at all. But I think more importantly, what we'd like to see is the USDA in particular and Congress in the Farm Bill, which is the piece of legislation that Congress debates every 5 years that really sets the rules and incentives for agriculture. We'd like to see those folks really get more serious about alternatives. Because, as I mentioned, the genetic engineering is complicated. It takes a long time to produce these crops and huge investments. And what we find is that simple plant breeding, the kind that is done at universities and by researchers at the U.S. Department of Agriculture itself, can actually achieve the kinds of goals that Monsanto and its competitors talk about more quickly and more cheaply and just more efficiently generally. But those plant breeders are really starved for resources in recent years. So we'd really like to see more research dollars going into simple plant breeding of the kind that can produce results.
That was Karen Perry Stillerman, Program Manager and Senior Analyst with the Union of Concerned Scientists Food and Environment Program. Find links examining Monsanto's claims on genetically engineered food crops by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In 2011, the Environmental Protection Agency promulgated stricter limits on ground-level ozone pollution, and top Environmental Protection Agency officials expected regulations to protect public health to be enacted, preventing thousands of heart attacks, the spread of asthma, and other respiratory illnesses. But responding to industry pressure, President Obama decided in September 2011 not to authorize the regulations, blindsiding EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson and leading some to speculate that she would resign in protest, but she didn't. Paul Anastas headed up the Center for Green Chemistry and Green Engineering at Yale University when he was tapped by Barack Obama for the high-level position of science advisor to the EPA, working directly under Lisa Jackson. He was confirmed in late December 2009 and served until he resigned in March 2012. His tenure coincided with the BP oil spill disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, some controversial decisions around mountaintop removal mining, and the development and eventual abandonment of the ozone regulations. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Anastas in his office at Yale, to which he returned after resigning from his position at the EPA. Here he provides an insider's view on how scientific advice is used to formulate government policy, as he explains that many other economic and political forces come into play to determine which policies are put into place and which are not.
I think the science is showing increased importance controlling ozone concentrations, that the newly emerging science is something that increases concern rather than alleviates it. I think that Lisa Jackson has made it clear that this is something that will continue to be important and that will be looked at and revisited appropriately as the law states that it must. But I think nobody questions the science. The president doesn't question the science. Administrator Jackson doesn't question the science. And I think that it's important that we keep an eye on what the emerging science is for people in terms of its impact, especially on small children, vulnerable populations of ozone, especially as we see more and more air quality days that are of concern.
The whole question of the integrity of science in U.S. policymaking, certainly the George W. Bush administration was criticized heavily for completely abandoning the science for basically support for industry's positions. And I know the Union of Concerned Scientists, as Obama was coming in to office, you know, there was this big campaign to get people to sign up to say, please, you know, base your decisions on science. I mean, from their perspective, every decision that a government makes is up for question if you're not basing it on that. How do you feel the Obama administration ranks in that arena?
I think the most important thing that I can say is that because of the direct orders from the President of the United States to his science advisor, John Holdren, who also heads up the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, the entire scientific apparatus of the United States government is directed to put in place firm scientific integrity frameworks and plans and actions that speak directly to preserving this kind of scientific integrity. I'm very happy to say that we were able to finalize the scientific integrity plan for the EPA on my last day as science advisor and as head of research and development. And the strictest adherence to those principles, to those plans of ensuring the highest quality science through, of course, the peer review, always making sure that any kind of scientific or research misconduct is, there's absolute zero tolerance, that make sure that science cannot, must not, and will not be politicized. The freedom of scientists to speak openly and freely to not only the public, but the press and testimony. Those principles are absolutely essential. They're bedrock. And I compliment the president and the president's science advisor, John Holdren, and Lisa Jackson for shepherding these kinds of plans and putting them in place.
But doesn't that kind of, the decision around the ozone, doesn't that kind of contradict what everything you just said about making that the top priority?
Science is an essential and important voice at the table. And the quality of that science and the integrity of that science cannot and must not be impugned. The president did not impugn that science. The administrator did not impugn that science. There are other drivers. There are other forces. There are economic considerations. There are policy considerations that go into the equation. Well, as a scientist, I might wish that the only factor was science. It's important to remember that we live in a society where many, many factors need to be judged, deliberated upon, and the conclusions reached and the decisions made based on all of those factors.
That was Paul Anastas, former science advisor to EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson. He currently serves as director of Yale University's Center for Green Chemistry and Green Engineering. Find more perspectives on science and politics on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Green Party of the United States has run candidates for president since 1996, when Ralph Nader first undertook a national campaign. Nader's candidacy 4 years later in 2000, where he won almost 3 million votes, was the focus of much news coverage when the citizen activist was blamed as a spoiler by supporters of Democratic candidate Al Gore. At issue was the former vice president's loss in the state of Florida by 537 votes after a controversial U.S. Supreme Court decision prohibited a recount of all ballots cast in the state. Since 2000, the Green Party has continued to run candidates at the local, state, and federal level, but no candidate has had as much national impact as Ralph Nader. Currently, the Green Party holds more than 130 local offices, including mayors, members of city councils, and school boards. But the U.S. winner-take-all system, where Republicans and Democrats dominate, has been a major obstacle to the Greens and other third parties, who are unable to effectively challenge electoral rules that freeze out and marginalize minor party candidates. This in contrast to the success of many other Green parties in Europe and around the world, where systems of proportional representation have seen Greens win enough seats in federal elections to serve as partners in coalition governments. This year, the U.S. Green Party presidential nominee is Jill Stein, a physician from Massachusetts who, as a Green, challenged Mitt Romney for governor of Massachusetts in 2002. Her vice presidential running mate is Sherry Hunkela, national coordinator for the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. Stein won the nomination over TV star Roseanne Barr. Stein's campaign is built around her Green New Deal that advocates the right to a job at a living wage, transition to a sustainable green economy, a financial sector serving Americans, and citizen empowerment. Your reporter spoke with Jill Stein, who talks about her platform and why progressive voters should consider supporting her candidacy this November.
We are on track to be on the ballot in somewhere around 42, 45 states, so that somewhere between 90 and 95% of voters will have a real choice. When they walk into the voting booth, they won't have to choose between just two candidates that have been both bought and paid for by Wall Street. We are currently on the ballot in about 21 states plus the District of Columbia, and those are states who've already had their deadlines, and we are on track to be on the ballot in most of the remaining states.
In comparison to previous years' presidential candidates for the Green Party, is that pretty good? Sounds good.
Yes, it is. It is good, and it reflects, I think, that it's a whole new ballgame out there, and a lot of people who had wandered away from the party, you know, in the years where there was a lot of hope out there for Barack Obama and the Democratic Party illusion, a lot of those people are wandering back now, saying that this politics of fear that said you had to go for, you know, your fears, you had to vote your fears and not what you really want and deserve and the real solutions that we need to get behind, that strategy has not been, you know, it's basically been a strategy of silence, political silence, and that doesn't move you forward at all. In fact, it just unleashes the brakes on the system and allows us to accelerate in the wrong direction. So our motto now, or one of our mantras, is that the politics of fear has actually delivered everything we were afraid of, all those reasons we were told to just, you know, be quiet, go along to get along, do the lesser evil thing, you know, because you didn't want an expanding war, you didn't want the attack on our civil liberties, you didn't want these massive Wall Street bailouts, you didn't want the climate meltdown. We've gotten all of that in enormous, huge quantities because there has not been an opposition voice. That opposition has basically been lulled to sleep under a Democratic president who has embraced most of the key policies of George Bush. That's not to say there aren't some differences around the margins. There are, but those differences aren't enough to save your life or to save your jobs or to provide your health care. You know, on count after count, we're basically getting the Republican agenda in a nice, friendly, Democratic wrapper with, you know, with beautiful oratory.
In the minds of many people in the country who are Democratic voters or lean Democratic, Ralph Nader in that candidacy and the Green Party ticket was blamed as being the spoiler and throwing the election to George Bush. Whether or not that's true, how do you respond to the, you know, what's often said about third parties is that the structure is such in our country now. We have a winner-take-all system, and it's very difficult to imagine a Green Party or any third party rising to the levels of the major parties to actually have a possibility of winning. That the lesser of two evilism, I guess, is still alive out there, where people consider, you know, a Romney candidacy versus an Obama candidacy, and maybe don't like either one, but will ignore the third party, feeling that a protest vote may be just throwing their vote away.
Unfortunately, the undemocratic system that we have serves the current ruling parties very well, so they are not interested in reforming them at all, which is why we can't just sit back and try to create a fair system and then we'll run. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. We've been asking nicely for a long time. It doesn't work. So we have to actually run. And most people are really working hard right now. You know, one out of every two Americans is either in poverty or low income and heading towards poverty. And these numbers are just, they continue to climb as wages continue to decline. So we're addressing, you know, the key issues, the key survival issues that people are really grappling with. We want to create jobs for every American, put an end to unemployment. We know how to do this. We did it in the Great Depression in the 1930s. That's what we call the Green New Deal. So it solves the economic problem at the same time that it solves the climate crisis, because it creates jobs in our communities that transition us to the clean energy economy for the future. So we're focusing on that, but we attach to it democracy reform. They're actually part of our Green New Deal, which calls for not only creating jobs, but also financial reforms that enable us to make the investments that we need to create these jobs, and the democracy reforms, including things like instant runoff voting, getting big money out of politics, freeing the public airwaves so that those private corporations who use them have to provide free public airtime to qualified candidates and other important public interest issues and campaigns, so that the public airwaves are actually used for the public benefit. The minute you do that, you know what happens? The bottom goes out of the cost of campaigns, because that's where the big money goes. So suddenly, if you free up the airwaves, then the predators can throw as much money as they want at their favorite candidates, but they no longer have an advantage because they can't buy the media anymore. This is in our hands. The future's in our hands. Nobody's going to do it for us. And we have to decide whether we're going to have a planet and a society that are habitable by human beings, and whether we're going to maintain civilization. Or are we going to just let it fall apart and go back to the Dark Ages and worse?
That was Green Party presidential nominee Jill Stein. For more information on the Green Party and Jill Stein's candidacy, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris. Thank you.